From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Marilyn Hughes joins us, Principles of the World Beyond Death. I'm looking forward to this. Well, speaking of death, a radio legend died Saturday. Longtime Omaha radio icon Steve Brown passed away suddenly, shortly before his weekly afternoon talk show on our affiliate there, KFAB 1110. He had been the staple of Omaha radio since the late 1950s and was given credit for launching a number of radio careers that led to national recognition. Brown was part of the Star Stations group in the early 60s that helped even lead the trend of rock music stations. Services for Steve Brown will be held on December 17th at the Heffy Hoffman Funeral Home. Steve Brown, he'll be missed. About 400,000 power customers in New England are still without electricity after an ice storm ravaged the region last week. That's down from 800,000 Sunday evening and more than a million at the height of the storm. Let me tell you, almost the entire country is getting hit with cold and severe weather. Maybe the woolly worms were right, huh? Those little creepy insects, those caterpillar likes, they grew a lot of little fuzz hair over this winter. I think they knew something. As a matter of fact, Las Vegas got hit with snow. That's how strange things are. Wonder what the odds would have been on that one, huh? A federal judge has signed an order saying investors who may have been duped in one of Wall Street's biggest frauds need the protection of the Securities Investor Protection Act. Now, I don't know exactly how all this is going to come about, but the order came just days after federal prosecutors charged a fellow by the name of Madoff with securities fraud, saying that he had admitted squandering nearly $50 billion from investors in a massive Ponzi scheme. Now, some of the companies that have been hit with this, HSBC, one of the world's largest banking groups, also bank, could lose $1 billion. The Royal Bank of Scotland, $600 million. Francis Paribas, they could lose $468 million. And the list goes on and on and on. Bernard Madoff, a former chairman of the NASDAQ exchange market, was arrested Thursday on a single securities fraud charge of operating a $50 billion Ponzi scheme from his investment advisory business. Now, in terms of insurance and Securities Investor Protection Act, what will happen there, I don't know yet, but $50 billion. The Federal Reserve is widely expected to ratchet down a key interest rate, perhaps to an all-time low, to prevent the sinking economy from falling even deeper into the doldrums. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and his colleagues will take another fresh look at this tomorrow, hoping to stop the slide. Home values, they've been hit hard. The American homeowners will collectively lose more than $2 trillion in home value by the end of 2008. Some 11.7 million Americans are now what they call underwater, owing more on their mortgage balances than their homes are worth. Casinos, lottery agencies, and racetracks are losing tons of money as gamblers play it safe, laying to rest once and for all the old adage that gambling is a recession-proof industry. The Nevada Gaming Control Board reported last week that revenue at the state's casinos fell by 22% in October compared with the same month last year. It was the 10th straight monthly decline and the biggest ever. The story was even worse on the Las Vegas Strip, where October the take was down by 26%. President George W. Bush's plan to aid the impoverished U.S. automakers likely will follow the structure of a previous deal with congressional leaders, according to a Michigan senator. Democratic Senator Carl Levin said that he expects Mr. Bush to abide by the earlier deal, which would provide loans for General Motors and Chrysler to help them survive until March 31st. They're talking about $14 billion. Others are saying this could go as high as $40 billion. In Iraq, where President Bush was, he wrapped up a whirlwind trip to two war zones, including Afghanistan Monday, that in many ways was a victory lap without a clear victory. A signature event occurred when an Iraqi reporter who's been arrested tossed two shoes at Mr. Bush, an incident the president called a bizarre moment. Now, in the Arabic culture, and the reporter was arrested, in the Arabic culture, that when you throw shoes at someone, that means that you are holding them in contempt. So that's what he meant by that, and they arrested him in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Police say a man there was arrested for throwing a sandwich at his girlfriend, the second food attack that has sent a man to jail in about a month. According to a police report, the 20-year-old man threw the sandwich at his girlfriend's face during an argument. He then hit her on top of the head with his fist before taking off. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected now a second challenge to the presidency of Barack Obama, announcing that it denied an application for a stay or injunction in a case now from Connecticut. The case was brought by Court Rotnowski. It had been distributed for review by the court and apparently was considered during a conference of the justices late on Friday. And they decided not to look into whether he is eligible to be president based on his birth. So another one tossed out by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court also handed down a surprising defeat to tobacco companies, counting on it to put an end to lawsuits alleging deceptive marketing of light cigarettes. In a 5-4 split won by the court's liberals, it ruled that smokers may use state consumer protection laws to sue cigarette makers for the way they promote light and low-tar brands. Archaeologists in China are baffled after finding a tiny Swiss watch in a 400-year-old tomb. This is a little tiny thing. You'd see the story at coasttocoastam.com. The watch ring was discovered as archaeologists were making a documentary. The tomb is 400 years old. This is a little watch. They can't figure it out. And also at coasttocoastam.com, a hotel in Romania has become a local attraction after a photograph of a ghost was published by newspapers and television. The ghost of a tall woman in a long white dress reportedly watches the hallways and staircases of the hotel. It's a 150-year-old hotel, and the ghost apparently is trying to keep locals away from treasure hunting. You can see the ghost on this picture. It is kind of remarkable. In a moment, David Schmick joins us, author of The World is Curved, Hidden Dangers to the Global Economy. We're going to be talking about this Ponzi scheme, China, and some other issues that affect all of us. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And we're bringing you still another voice now in this financial calamity everybody's in. David Schmick is the chairman and chief executive officer of Johnson Schmick International. Now, that's a financial market advisory firm. It's based in Washington, D.C., founded in 1985. The firm was the very first of its kind to provide strategic informational services on very important global economic political policy changes to the large macroeconomic-oriented hedge funds and proprietary trading departments of major financial institutions. David is the founder, editor, and publisher as well of the International Economy magazine, and here he is on Coast to Coast this hour. David, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great Good. To be with you.
Likewise. Now, this situation with this so-called Ponzi scheme with Madoff, how could someone pull that off for 20 years and nobody know about it?
It is pretty amazing. I mean, this guy was, for one thing, he was a very nice man, and people who met him was not a close friend of mine or anything. But when people met him, they they thought, what a nice man. He remembers your first name. And he seemed like so successful. But you got to ask yourself, here's the guy. Oh, one of the other things too is that, you know, he would give speeches, and he regularly, and he would say things like, I saw a quote today. He said in a 2007 conference, he said, in today's regulatory environment, it's virtually impossible to violate rules. And I was like, oh, I said, you know, it's the audacity of the whole thing. And but, you know, it wasn't as if it was totally a mystery. I mean, here's a guy who his fund allegedly lost money in only two of 214, you know, rolling quarterly periods
yeah.
since 1990. Now you gotta scratch your head and say, I mean, people were saying this is like automatic money and riskless risk and all the rest, and who were invested in that, and you know, they, I mean, somebody should have. You know, well, there were people who started to scratch their head quite a while ago, but not enough.
I would guess, David, let's say, now we're talking about $50 billion that he, over 20 years, touched in his fund, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that means $50 billion in investment money. And I would guess if somebody was getting bought out or they wanted out, he would just take money from Peter and pay Paul.
Yeah, that's how a Ponzi scheme works. In other words, as long as I've got, if I'm running the Ponzi, you know, the scam, as long as I have new investors coming in, all hopeful, and this guy was very clever because he would, you know, he'd kind of reject people.
He'd make them hungry to want to come in.
Yeah, he was kind of shrewd. He knew who the blabbermouths were, and so somebody would come to him and he'd say, I'm sorry, we just can't take you now. And, of course, that guy would run around in various communities and say, boy, you can't get in there. I tried to get in. And then, which, of course, would make everybody want to get in, and nobody asked questions. There was a point where they set up a policy where you couldn't meet. You were not allowed as an investor to doing your due diligence to even meet with Bernie Madoff. You know, it was like out of the question. You can't meet with the man who pulls the trigger on the fund, which was kind of an interesting. It was clever in this sense. It was the non-marketing. It was the ultimate in counterintuitive marketing. You know, you basically say, we don't really want your money, and by the way, if we do take your money, you know, I'm going to treat you like you're like dirt. You know,
yeah.
Like,
and so people, and you're going to like it.
Please let me in.
Yeah. Step on me.
Right.
Yeah, this federal judge now who has signed this order for the Securities Investor Protection Act, does that mean that everyone who lost money is going to get protected?
No, I don't. I mean, they'll get something back. It'll take years. I think that what's going to complicate this. I mean, I'm just speculating here, but.
And how much money's gone, David, of the $50 billion?
My guess is what's happened is some people got out. Right.
Yeah.
There's kind of the insiders and, you know, the close friends, I'm sure got tipped off. That would be my guess. And and so, you know, they were told and suddenly they were able to get some money out. And I think what the bankruptcy judge, I suspect, will be to go back to a certain point and say, you know, any redemptions after that point, you know, probably going to be returned to the pot, to the pool, you know, and that's assuming people still have that money. But, you know, then you're going to have, it's going to be a securities lawyer's dream, because every lawyer is going to say, well, my client wasn't tipped off. He just, you know, kind of knew himself that this was the time to get out of the market, you know, and so it, you're talking about a mess, and it reaches so many. I mean, you do get the feeling with a story like this is, you know, we've barely scratched the surface. This is going to be thing, and it's going to be, it's like the worst thing that could happen to Wall Street
at the wrong time, at the worst time.
Absolutely worst time, because, you know, Wall Street operates under trust, and, you know, all these people who are running around now saying, well, this is the problem, you know, we don't have enough regulation. Well, this outfit was a broker dealer, and what that means is heavily regulated by the SEC. The problem is not that they didn't have the regulation, but regulators were asleep. And you know, I have, you know, in my book, The World is Curved, you know, I make an argument that I wonder if the regulators are ever going to be a match for the sophistication and the cleverness of the Wall Street operators and their Wall Street attorneys, who, you know, they're constantly thinking of ways, legal ways around, you know, every regulatory proposal, but even before it's promulgated.
Yeah.
And there's a whole industry in Washington, and it's just set up, and New York is set up to get around this stuff. And, you know, I was asking a guy at Goldman Sachs not that long ago, about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I said, you know, let me ask you, if you guys met a regulator who was really brilliant in Washington, say, or New York at the SEC, or one of the, you know, the comptroller's office, or the FDA, you know, or at the Fed, what would you do? He said, we'd hire him.
Exactly. He'd be working for a corporation making a fortune.
I mean, the regular and the senior official at the SEC earns about $160,000 to $190,000 a year. At Goldman Sachs, maybe not today's Goldman Sachs, but until recently, secretaries were earning $200,000 a year.
Unbelievable.
And
so,
and these executives are earning, several million a year, the junior executives. These are very sophisticated people. And and you can't blame the regulators entirely. I mean, they were in to see this Bernie Madoff's operation all the time, and they just, if you got someone who's clever at hiding risk and playing games, the regulators are no match. It's kind of a fundamental problem our system is now faced with.
Yeah, and you wonder if people got paid off too, David. We don't know that yet.
No, but you wonder.
But you never know. It couldn't come at a worse time. I mean, we got slapped with a mortgage situation many months ago, which was just the tip of the iceberg, and then everything else collapses. I mean, it's got to be worse. And my guests who've been coming on over the last several months now, the Catherine Austin Fitz, Gerald Salentes and people, and we're going to add you to the mix now. I mean, these people have warned us that it's going to get far worse before it gets better. And then you look at these situations here with this Madoff case and you go, my God, how bad can it get?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I in pushing my book, I've been giving speeches around, and I find sometimes you can tell people get a little depressed. But I say, look, I'd rather tell you, the way it is. But I count 8 bubbles that could burst in one form or another. We are fixated, because of the media has got us fixated on one bubble, the subprime related mortgage problem, which is significant. But I count 8, and the bubbles range from the subprime mortgage link loans, which are about $1.5 trillion in exposure. Then you have emerging market debt at $5 trillion. You have that credit card debt. I think that's about $2.5 trillion. Commercial real estate, $25 trillion. There's something called foreign exchange derivatives, which is a $56 trillion market. Then there's this thing that you see mentioned in the news a lot called the credit default swaps. When you add up all these 8, you're over $200 trillion. Now, listeners, you say, all these numbers, what do they mean? Because it's confusing. But if the potential first, bubble is $200 trillion. Let's assume a conservative assumption that, those bubbles burst in the worst-case scenario, and everything's worth 10% less.
Right.
Or to the 10% default, depending on how it is. So that's a $20 trillion problem. Now, the world's GDP is only $50 trillion. So you can see why.
Cut in half.
Yeah, why global markets look out there and they say, man, in a worst case, this is frightening stuff. They have reason to be nervous in a worst case. So, it's not pretty. And I also think that when I look at what's coming out of Washington, I don't sense that they even understand, how we got to where we are. I mean, they just seem to be, it's like Washington is, they're looking at this in such a surface way, like they're a bunch of firefighters looking through the rearview mirror saying, let's come up with an ad hoc approach to every little fire. Oh, we have a fire. Let's put it out. But they're not looking at it in a fundamental sense.
I bet George Bush can't wait to get out of the White House.
I can't imagine. It felt great to have that shoe flying at him, that was one of those periods where you say to yourself, was that like a Saturday Night Live?
I know it.
Jay Leno.
And the way he ducked, which was pretty good, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh my God, David. Yeah, I'm going to keep you around for phone calls for the next half hour, but there's much more to talk with you about too, because you see China as a big problem as well, don't you?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that what's happening, if you go back and you say, how did we get into this problem? How did it really start? And what I say in my book is that we got into this when it started when the Berlin Wall fell. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but, you know, the Berlin Wall came down, the communist model collapsed, and by the early 1990s, you had a number of economies, emerging economies, coming on the scene. China, India, the Eastern European economies.
And a struggling Russia.
And a struggling Russia. And
David, we're going to... We'll come right back with you, and we'll have you pick that up right from there. And then we'll take some calls, too. Hey, if you haven't signed up yet for the free Coast Zone newsletter, do so by going to coasttocoastam.com and just register right there. It's right there on the homepage. This week, you're going to get a sneak peek of the new coasttocoastam.com website. And the newsletter is an e-newsletter. It's delivered right to your computer every morning. So enjoy it. It's free. Coast Zone. It's a newsletter. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with David Schmeck. The World is Curved is his book. And, of course, he has a financial advisory firm. Might have made a monster with you, David. Every phone line's jammed here, and I'm not even done chatting with you. But here we go. So you say that when the Berlin Wall went down, things started.
I'd say one of the reasons I wrote my book is I felt like all of Washington was talking. You know, I started this book before the crisis. I had predicted this was all going to unfold, but Washington is so oriented toward the domestic when this problem is global. And it really started in the last several decades because after the fall of the Berlin Wall, I mean, China, India, Eastern Europe, they all wanted to be capitalist countries. They developed the model and the world, it's called the emerging market export model. And what that means is, the rest of the world wanted to be exporters, and they tied their currencies to the dollar, and they set themselves up as export machines, and that's led by China and the U.S. and to a certain extent Europe, and we were the consumers of last resort. America's not been a saving economy; it's a consuming economy, and so we had this. Global imbalances run, but it was basically a situation in which emerging markets, again led by China, exported their goods to us. We sent them our dollars. They then built up huge mountains of foreign exchange reserves. In other words, excess savings.
Yeah.
And then they recycled it back to us and bought our treasury paper, and all that was fine. And the assumption was that the global economy would never weaken. And, of course, what's happening right now is, you know, global demand is plummeting. And what you're seeing is the end of this model, the end of our way of doing business in the world is it's crashing right now. The whole model is crumbling. And you're seeing emerging markets probably going to have big defaults coming up on their bank debt. You know, when what's very interesting about this period, we've been through the last year up until about a month and a half ago, in which the Europeans have had this attitude toward America. It's called, it can be defined in the German phrase, Schadenfreude, which is translated means gaining pleasure at the misery of others. And the Europeans have said, oh, you poor Americans, you have your subprime problem. And isn't that pathetic, and you deserve it. And suddenly now you're seeing the Europeans terrified because
yes.
It turns out that their exposure, their banks, their exposure to emerging market debt, I mean investments collapsing in the emerging markets is anywhere from 5 to 6 times our subprime exposure. So my point in all this is, the world is in trouble because that model is breaking down because the world economy is weakening so fast.
And this global economy cannot take one more major hit, can it?
No. I mean, we are really up there. And, you know, when you look at the credit crisis and you say, what is the real danger of the last year? The real danger of the credit crisis is that the world's capital moves to the sidelines. Now, in the 1930s, people would stuff, you know, money into mattresses, and in the 21st century, they just buy short-term government debt. It's why the U.S. Treasury bill market, you know, did you see the other day, it went into the negative territory.
Negative, first time, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, and that's because people are scared. They move to the sideline. It's one of the silver linings in our system. It's not that the world doesn't have capital. It's just it's sitting on the sidelines. I think there's $6 trillion in money market funds alone globally. But, you know, the danger is that because of this weakness around the world that we get political risk. And that will then – political risk means if say, China implodes, then you'll get the part of the world's capital that's still engaged in productive uses, that'll move to the sidelines. And I'm worried about China. I went back recently, and this is all in my book, The World is Curved. I went back and I looked at the, you know, since the late 50s, early 60s, the three periods in China's history where there was huge political and social tensions and you know, riots in the streets. And there was the Great Leap Forward period in the late 50s, I guess through 61. There was the Cultural Revolution, everybody remembers, a little bit later. And then there's the Tiananmen Square massacres. And in those three periods of social turmoil, they all developed after China's growth had gone from the 10 to 11% range down to the 4 to 5.5% range. For instance, during the Tiananmen Square massacre and all that tension, growth in four quarters plummeted from 11 down to 4.2%. So I look at today, and I look at China. China a year ago was growing at almost 12%. Most experts in the, you know, in the high, I mean, if you ask the Chinese government, they'll tell you they're doing fine. Maybe not doing fine, but they sugarcoat everything. The Hong Kong banks, and they tend to know best about what's going on in China, they tell me China's probably growing at 5% right now. So we're back to that kind of situation, and the tensions in China are unbelievable. And why? Because you have hundreds of millions of people who've been promised they could join the middle class. Not only can the Chinese leadership, because you know no one's buying their exports now, not only can't they employ those people, but they're having to lay off, you know, by the tens of millions now, people that had come off the countryside and been given factory jobs, and had joined the middle class just in recent years. And so, in China, you can see it angry. China has, you forget what the government tells you. A friend of mine called me the other day. He said I'm on a highway in southwest China, heading toward the coast. I've been on this highway, you know, for the last 15 years, every 6 weeks, it's usually full of trucks. It's now empty.
And see, empty, there's an indicator right there.
China's in trouble.
Let's take some calls. First-time caller, Ronald in Oyster Bay, New York. You're up with us. Hey, Ronald.
Yes, good morning. Welcome from Oyster Bay. As you may know, it was the home of Teddy Roosevelt.
Absolutely.
Now, I have a couple of comments. First of all, Mr. Norrie, it seems to me all the time I listen to the show, not as often as I would like, but all the guests that I can recall, it's all gloom and doom. How about having some guests that might have something positive to say about the future and about what might be coming? The second point is...
Well, I'm all for that, Ronald, once we get out of the doom and gloom, which is real.
But also, whenever there are difficulties, there are always tremendous opportunities. And right now, there's the opportunity to buy stock in great companies at a real discount.
That's for people who have the money to afford it, Ronald, and most of the people can't.
I'm not talking about buying a lot, but maybe a little bit here and there instead of other things. For people that invest, you know, a little bit here and there, not necessarily, certainly not talking about the wealthy, but middle-class people, too.
Ronald, the middle class right now are just getting by. I don't think they have disposable income to buy stocks. That's my guess.
And that brings me to my third and final point. Your guest is absolutely right. We're not a saving nation. We're a spending nation. I think one thing the government can and should do to help encourage savings is not to tax interest income on savings. I think that would do a lot to get people to save more, that they wouldn't be taxed.
What do you think of an overhaul of the entire tax code, David?
Well, I think that, you know, the tax code needs to be overhauled every decade, frankly. And I would love to see a simpler, tax system, both on the individual but and on the corporate level. And I, you know, my argument is it has to be done once every 10 or 15 years, because the tax writing committees in Washington, they're major fundraising sources for members of Congress. And so what happens if you go through tax reform, and I was involved in the 88 tax reform and in the and in 1981 in the tax legislation then, you know, if you, it's like cleaning out the barn, and then you come back in 10 years, the barn's back and full of manure. But I think we when you look at the corporate tax system right now, it's not a system that's set up. It's set up to encourage American corporations to go offshore, and it should be set up in a way to bring foreign corporations here. We want to attract, it seems to me, investment from abroad, and the corporate tax system definitely needs to be reformed.
Let's go to David, Las Vegas, Nevada. It's cold out there, David, isn't it?
Hi, George. Yeah, welcome to snowy Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's strange, huh?
David, the $700 billion allocated to the banking system, why was that money not allocated to mortgage holders?
Well, and you're it's a sensitive issue, because I don't like to be, you know, nasty to these people who come to Washington and work in these jobs. I mean, they make sacrifices. But our Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, I think this has been an absolute disaster the way he has unfolded. First of all, he's terrible at communicating his ideas. But I don't think that $700 billion package, it didn't have an overarching game plan to it.
No, never did. And they never shared it with us, if they had one.
I tell you, I know exactly what happened, because I talked to people with the Federal Reserve, and they said what happened is Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, called up Hank Paulson and said, I'm not going to put any more of this bailout stuff on the Fed's balance sheet, at least not now. You got to go to Capitol Hill. So Paulson went up to Capitol Hill, and first thing he did, he pulled this plan out of his back pocket. It was 2.5 pages. Threw it against the wall to see if it would stick. And so, oh, I guess that's our plan. And it was poorly conceived. Initially, it was to, as you know, remove the toxic waste, you know, the subprime, mortgages, the bad paper from the bank balance sheets. But then it quickly shifted to to buying preferred stock from banks.
Yeah.
And to, you know, the idea was you could more quickly inject capital into the banking system. Now, let me tell you, just the other day, I was looking at some data. Now, banks normally, before this mess, the American banks don't keep a lot of cash around. They tend to lend to each other. And the amount of cash they keep is called excess cash reserves. And normally they keep somewhere between $3 and $7 billion, all the banks, because they're lending to each other, the rest of it. I looked the other day. The excess cash reserves of the American banks are between $600 and $700 billion. If you can believe, the American banks, and a part of that is money from that $700 billion taxpayer-funded plan that Paulson came up with. The banks are sitting on, you know, this mountain of capital. They're not lending. Now, when you ask them why aren't they lending, they say, well, it's a little bit of chicken and egg. Like, we're not lending because 2009 is going to be a terrible year.
We've got to be ready for it. Yeah.
2009 is going to be a terrible year because the banks aren't lending. So, but they also make a case that the regulators, including the Fed, are saying, you know, the regulatory side is telling the banks, you have to put away more rainy day capital. You know, one of the banks were criticized, they, in fact, were big culprits in this whole credit crisis, because they, in order to get around these, you know, the regulations that require banks, when they take on additional risk, to put aside rainy day capital, the banks The way they got around that is they set up independent off-balance sheet vehicles. And so now the same regulators who were asleep at the switch when the banks were kind of hiding risk are now have come and said, don't take any risk. So we have gone from a situation of, in this country, of, you know, reckless financial risk-taking to something that may be even more dangerous. We're now in a situation of no financial risk-taking. And the banks are sitting on the cash. And, you know, you would think that the Treasury would have said before handing, you know, Bank of America, you know, it's $15 billion. By the way, are you going to lend this money into, you know,
stimulate the economy?
Nobody asked them. So what's one of the first things is the bank? I mentioned Bank of America, not Citi Group or some of the others, because Bank of America, after they got their money, they couldn't lend to Americans and the mortgage holders, but they found the time to use some of that money to double their ownership of a Chinese bank. And I consider that outrageous.
Yeah, me too. Why did they buy out AIG and save that insurance company? What was there that they wanted to protect, David?
Well, there's a lot of suspicion. They, you know, wanted to protect Goldman Sachs. And Goldman would have been affected heavily by AIG. And so I think they also, I think when they let Lehman Brothers collapse, they miscalculated kind of the global exposure and the effect just around the world on the credit markets. They underestimated that, and so they panicked when AIG came but there's a lot of suspicion too that, you know, maybe Lehman had a lot of foreign investment. Maybe they didn't, the European and Asian investors in Lehman Brothers didn't have the clout that, say, the
Goldman Sachs
Goldman
people.
And some of the others that were much more exposed than AIG.
Well, we know Paulson used to run Goldman Sachs.
Well, it's a very incestuous world. Washington, D.C. is America's new financial center. And, I think if this system is going to run the way the system that we're moving to right now, we had better have a vigilant press corps that looks at these conflicts, because there are conflicts everywhere now when you have this kind of government involvement in the financial system.
Absolutely. Let's grab one more quick question east of the Rockies, Gary in Connecticut. Gary, go ahead.
Gentlemen, this is a great show. It was 5 years ago today that President Bush signed into law the American Dream Down Payment Act, which let unqualified people, including illegal aliens, get home loans without down payments. This caused the market to crash in September, destroying our 401s and IRAs. You know, billions of our tax money is spent on illegal aliens, and financial experts exclude this. So America appears to me is going quietly into the night.
Yeah, well, it's scary right now what's going on. You know, one of the things I say in my book, The World is Curve, is that, you know, you ask yourself, here we have a global economy of, several hundred trillion dollars. How could a subprime market, even if you said a subprime market of, say, $200 billion, and let's say of the $200 billion, even if you said a third of the subprime mortgages defaulted, you're still talking, a relatively small amount of money in a global economy of, hundreds of trillions. And you say, how could the subprime situation, how could it topple, the world's financial system and bringing us conditions that are similar to the 1930s. And I like to use the salad analogy. And the salad.
Hey, David, we're gonna have a split, my friend. We're at the top of the hour, but I do want to get you back for a lengthier show, okay? David M. Schmick. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.